And welcome, friends, to the Generations Broadcast. Kevin Swanson with you today. Today, one of my favorite topics, and that is getting back to science, as that was my training early on in my college days, and continue to write science books for our Christian discipleship curriculum. Just finished our God Made the World textbook, which dealt with introductory physics and chemistry for roughly 10 to 11-year-olds. And that was fun. Enjoy coming back to science. Just finished a chapter in The Rise and Fall in the West, on the rise and fall of Western science, and just the huge developments that occurred, these massive revolutions that occurred exclusively with Christians. If it had not been for the Christian revolution of Merton College in the 1300s, and that was all Christian, and then on into the Newtonian revolution with Newton, Boyle, others, roughly 98% of the scientists involved in the Second Revolution were committed Christians. And then on into the revolution of the 19th century with the development of the electromagnetic theory of Michael Faraday and a few others. And again, exclusively Christians. By God's grace, he gave tremendous gifts and insight to followers of the Lord Jesus Christ to develop the hard sciences over about 600 or 700 years. That's impressive, friends. Something happened in the Western world. Something happened with these tremendous revelations that came to the world. And of course, all the technological benefits that flow from them, that comes from Christians. So really thrilled to come back to the topic of science. And sadly, science has been somewhat eroded, at least the foundations for right science has been somewhat eroded in a post-Christian age, but it's not for us to be discouraged because we have such a great heritage. Well, today we're going to look at the brain. God on the Brain is the name of this book. And the naturalist materialistic worldview does not present the brain as made in the image of God. It just simply doesn't. The naturalist materialist worldview presents the brain as chemical processes, much like grass growing in the backyard. So we ask the question, whence come ideas then? Whence come the moral conscience? Whence comes right and wrong, given that the brain is nothing more than chemical processes, much like grass growing in the backyard? What about logic? What about cognitive propositions? Are these things just the product of chemical processes in a material world? And why should I pay attention to grass growing in the backyard, given you've got a discussion with a materialist, somebody who doesn't believe in a supernatural worldview, but a purely naturalistic worldview? You simply ask them, well, what is all this conversation? Where is this coming from? Well, he says, it's coming from my brain. Well, whence comes the brain? Well, the brain is a massive accident in a disorderly, chaotic world, and nothing more than a material chemical process. Well, if that be the case, then why are we having this discussion? So we need to be asking these basic questions from time to time, and that's the purpose of Bradley Sickler's new book, God on the Brain. Dr. Sickler is a philosophy professor in University of Northwestern in St. Paul, Minnesota, and he has just released this this tremendous book, God on the Brain, What Cognitive Science Does and Does Not Tell Us About Faith, Human Nature, and the Divine. Brad, welcome to the Generations Broadcast. It's good to have you with us today.
Thanks. It's good to be here. Good for you. Good of you to have me on.
Nothing more fun than talking about science with a fellow scientist. You have your undergraduate degree in physics, I take.
I did. Yeah, I studied physics as an undergrad. I annoyed a lot of my professors by asking questions that they didn't think were appropriate. And then I figured out a while later that what I really liked about it were the philosophical and theological implications of it, especially modern physics. Which is full of all sorts of bizarre and weird things, and more interestingly to me, things that have been applied to try to say, you know, what our theological perspective should be, you know, based on relativity or quantum mechanics. God couldn't know the future, or it couldn't all have been caused and under God's control, or God doesn't, there's no such thing as a God's eye perspective, and so there can't be any such doctrine as omniscience. I mean, a lot of those sorts of things that emerge from the modern physics of quantum mechanics and relativity. That's what first got me interested. And then I went to seminary And I've been ordained and I've pastored a few churches and I got my PhD in philosophy. And my interest then has always been in the intersection of theology, science, philosophy, and how to think rightly about those fields from a biblically grounded perspective.
Yeah, well, I think anybody who is trained in physics wants to be sure there's something of a foundation in metaphysics. You know, it's nice to have a crossover. And I think I have the same way of thinking. I got my Bachelor's of Science in Mechanical Engineering, then off to my MDiv with a lot of focus on apologetics. And so, you know, quite an interest in that as well. But a first question out of the gate, before we get to the book, and, you know, we were talking off air and I just, you know, thought this would be a good way to open up the discussion. The 20th and 21st centuries opened up so much more knowledge and understanding the complexities of the universe. You think about how much more we know about the expanse of the universe since the development of telescopes through the 20th century and then the scanning electron microscopes to get into the nature of the human cell and the body. And, you know, just you think about everything, including the brain. All of this stuff we've come to learn, and yet the scientific world became increasingly naturalistic and materialistic and was trying to defend the position that all of this is just chaos in a world of chance, and there is no meaning, there is no ultimate purpose or design in any of this. It seems to me the argument's getting more tenuous all the time. Now, of course, that's taken from my worldview perspective, but it doesn't that seem obvious?
Well, it does to me. I mean, this is where I think the biblical truth that some people can't see what's plain to them because their hearts are hardened. And I think there is a lot of that failure to apprehend what's right in front of their faces. And one of the courses I teach as a philosophy professor is the history of ancient philosophy. So we look at, you know, the big people like Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, but also people before them known as pre-Socratics and other groups that formed like the atomists, Leucippus and Democritus and people like that. And one of the things that is always fun for me is to watch my students say, wow, these arguments are the same arguments that atheists are making today, 2,000, 2,500 years later.
Wow.
They really haven't come up with anything new. Mm-hmm. They're still just trying to push a materialist perspective where everything is just matter in motion. They still have the same problems in how do we ground knowledge? Is a random concatenation of atoms really an approach that can give rise to the complexity and intricacy we see not only in living things, but in the finely tuned structure of the universe itself? I mean, these arguments are as old as any arguments we have in recorded thought. And all we've done is kind of beefed up some of the details, but the bones of the argument are the same. And skeptics have always been determined that they're going to look at the data, and no matter what they see, they're going to explain it away. And that really, I think, is, you know, does start with a spiritual disposition, an attitude of the heart. And of course, that is what the Bible identifies as the root problem behind all this. But just in terms of dealing with the arguments, I fail to see how our increasing understanding of, as I was saying, you know, the not only the complexity, but the mind-boggling improbabilities of all these things happening successfully by chance, or the, you know, the confidence that we have in our cognitive processes. I mean, even Darwin recognized that if he was right and there was no guidance behind any of this process he was proposing, he shouldn't have any more reason to be confident in his thoughts than in the thoughts of a monkey, because essentially that's what he was. So there's a real clash of perspectives. Are we, as the scriptures declare, created by God with a divine design plan a little lower than the angels, or are we created by a random, unintentional series of processes that only make us a little higher than the primates? And the science, in my opinion, is either neutral or favors the Christian perspective. But then especially when you consider all the other things that there are to account for, not just the scientific things, but the things outside of science, our experience, our beliefs about the objectivity of morality, the reliance we have on our mental processes and things like that, religious experiences, miracles, the reliability of the New Testament, the lives and testimony of the apostles, and on and on and on. The Christian perspective, you know, C.S. Lewis put it really well, and I can't quote him directly off the cuff, but he said something like, if I if I only start with science, I can't make room for a lot of these other aspects of life. But if I start with Christianity, I do make room for them and also for science itself. If I just start with the brain, I'm done. Like I've hobbled myself. I can't even get out of the gate. But if I start with a view of God's sovereignty and his creation, then I can fit it in along with everything else. So, yeah, I think the science, you know, very, very strongly supports the Christian perspective, especially when you pair it with all the other things there are to explain and account for.
Right. So when we get this impression that somehow science is up against theology, science opposes Christianity, you would take just the opposite position, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I would. And there may be particular things where, you know, people point to certain things in the scriptures, like, you know, to go back again a few centuries, as you so helpfully did at the beginning. If you think about the debate between geocentrism and heliocentrism, so is the earth orbiting the sun or is the sun orbiting the earth? One of the scriptures that people pointed to in that debate was Psalm 96:10, and there's a few other verses that say the same thing. The earth is firmly established. It cannot be moved. Or they talked about how Joshua commanded the sun to stand still, not to command the earth to stand still, but the sun. And so they say, see, they didn't know anything about science. They were wrong. You can't trust the Bible because it says the earth is firmly established. It cannot be moved. But now we know that it's not only spinning around on its axis, but it's also orbiting the sun. And the whole solar system is moving around the Milky Way galaxy, which is moving through the universe. So the Bible's wrong. You can't trust it. It's been proven wrong. Well, you and I and probably everybody else we know think that the earth orbits the sun, right? Do you think that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's so what we believe at this point, based upon the empirical data we've received.
Yeah. So then what you do is you say, well, the scriptures are really trying to get at God's sovereignty, the faithfulness of his promises, his ability, his power, his unquestioned authority to carry out his will. And when it talks about the earth being firmly established so that it cannot be moved, it's really talking about God himself being a trustworthy rock and a covenant partner in his faithfulness. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there may be times like that where scientific discoveries or whatever make us question an interpretation that we've had of something. But it's my firm conviction that they're never going to undermine the authority of Scripture or its message. And they're generally going to support it.
Yeah. And Christians have always been, even the Catholic Church, from what I could tell, before the Reformation, was involved. So much of the discoveries occurred in monasteries, you know. I mean, you know, or the Christian colleges of Oxford, I think Merton College, and elsewhere, so much of it was happening with Christians. And even you have all these instances in which these monks were involved in these scientific discoveries. Why were Christians so motivated to invention? In fact, I just read that the first eyeglasses were developed in a monastery in roughly 1320 or 1330. So many of the discoveries occurred in monasteries. And amongst Christians, why? Why were they motivated to discover God's universe?
Well, you know, it's been the case for a long time. Augustine said this kind of thing, that Christians have a responsibility not only to God, but to their fellow humans to study and understand nature and not speak falsely about it. Calvin doubled down on that and said, you know, it takes the skill of Galen, who was a scientist in the classical world, did some interesting experiments in anatomy and so forth, to rightly understand nature. And the study of God's handiwork is honoring to God. He's the creator. And when we study his works with an eye towards bringing him glory and praise, that pleases him. And, you know, Kepler, following the Newtonian revolution of applying gravity to external bodies out in space, Kepler said the same thing. We're trying to think God's thoughts after him. So pious Christians have always understood that as God's creation, the study and love of nature is a way of honoring God if you're doing it right. And that's by the way, too, you know, you speak about the history of the universities. You had to study theology that was known as the queen of the sciences, mm-hmm. because it was supposed to frame and put in context all of these other scientific endeavors and inquiries.
Well, let's take a look at the brain, because that's part of your specialty here, and that's what you're bringing out in God and the Brain, a new release from Crossway. What is the difference between a naturalistic, materialistic view of the brain and a Christian view of the brain?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not something like, you know, atheists think we have a hypothalamus and we don't. I mean, there's nothing like that.
Right.
So it's like so many things, as you're aware, I'm sure. It's not that there's disagreement about what the data are. It's disagreement about what the data mean, how to account for them, and how to sort of fit them into a worldview. Mm-hmm. So, you know, will a Christian look at an MRI or a PET scan or something and come up with a different conclusion about the state of the brain? No. But one of the things that happens is, you know, in the book, I deal with a few different aspects of this topic. So I deal with the question of whether we have souls. Mm-hmm. It seems to me pretty important to the biblical authors that we recognize we are spiritual beings, right?
Yes.
We have a body and
yes.
we have an immaterial element or mm-hmm. aspect to our persons, and that's important to them. It's important for Christology. It's important for, you know, that we believe as Jesus believed, which is part of what it means to follow him. And he certainly talks as if we are a soul and body union, as do, you know, the other New Testament authors and many of the Old Testament authors. So there's, you know, there's that aspect of it. You know, the reductionist project of trying to say all a human is a body with a brain. Everything a human does, experiences, thinks, believes, you know, including acts of worship and beliefs about God, all of those are just, like you were saying, they're just mechanical processes. And, you know, it's just like the same way that a steam engine gives off heat, you know, the brain gives off these kinds of thoughts. And that reductionist approach to humans, I think, is really out of step with a biblical understanding. So I also look at, in the book, how studies of the brain relate to what they call religious experiences. So the things that monks or nuns or, you know, Buddhist monks or whatever, the things that they report experiencing during their meditations or prayers, other things that have been, you know, experiments that have tried to induce feelings of awareness of the divine through, for example, the God helmet, which I talk about in the book. That's all interesting stuff, but if you start with the perspective that the brain is the extent of who we are and what we are, you're going to probably draw different conclusions from that than if you start with the perspective that the brain is a part of our body and the body is a part of what we are as soul-body unions, right? These mm-hmm. holistic single beings that have spiritual and material or physical elements. You're going to come to a totally different conclusion. And then you also try to understand another thing that I deal with in the book is why people believe in God. So again, if you're a materialist, a naturalist, you're going to say, you've got a very limited toolbox if you're a naturalist. You're going to have to try to explain everything that we are and everything that we do and believe in terms of evolutionary processes that take place because they promote survival and they develop as the result of some kind of mutation or something like that. So you have to then approach every question with only those two tools. How did this, you know, mutate or develop, and then why was it preserved? So belief in God is another example. Why did it develop and why is it preserved? You know, some people will try to explain that in terms of brain structure, evolutionary psychology, things like that. And most Christians will be sort of yelling from the back of the room, "Hey, we believe in God because there's a God and he wants us to believe in him. That's why he made us with that inclination." So, I mean, it just, all of the stuff relating to anything touching on the brain, how it got to be what it is, how it functions now, and the connections between the brain and Christian belief, That's kind of the range of things that I try to talk about in the book.
How do the materialists deal with the question of moral conscience and ethics? They've got to come to the conclusion that it's nothing but relative. And, you know, and at the end of the day, is there any room at all for cognition if the brain is nothing more than a chemical process?
Those are fantastic questions, and I address those in the book in a couple of different chapters. And the short answer is no, there isn't room for cognition. There, you should not trust your cognition, including if your cognition tells you there's no God. It's self-defeating in that way. The naturalistic, materialist, reductionist, atheist perspective is self-defeating. And the inescapable conclusion is that morality is a total illusion.
Yeah.
There is nothing to it. It's merely a trick played on us by evolutionary processes that found it useful. And I spend a lot of time in the book addressing those two concerns in particular, because I think, we talked about apologetics early on. I think they're extremely apologetically useful.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. No matter how committed they are to a secular mindset, most people don't want to say there are absolutely no moral truths at all. It's all just a joke. It's a joke played by evolution, and we need to snap out of it. I mean, most people find that extremely troubling and don't want to go there. But again, the Christian perspective can account for all of the things that we find when we do these brain studies or whatever else we're doing, in the biological lines, but also can explain why we are so convinced that morality is objective and why people have such a strong tendency to believe in the divine. It's because they're real. I mean, that's the Christian answer. And the secularist or the materialist or the naturalist has no safe ground to retreat to on those questions.
Now, let's get to the question of metaphysics, the tension between determinism and indeterminism. These are the only two options you get, as far as I can tell, when it comes to metaphysics. That is, why do things happen the way they happen? Either we're living in a deterministic world or an indeterministic world. If this is, just a material world of chance. In fact, don't you always tip into indeterminism ultimately?
Well, people certainly live as if indeterminism is true. We deliberate about our choices. We hold each other responsible for things we've done through moral praise or moral blame. We act as if we have real agency. But I talk about this in the book, and here's kind of how I land on it.
Okay.
If you are an indeterminist, really the only way to shoehorn in any kind of liberty is with a soul. If the soul as part of your person is a factor in what you do and what you think. If you don't have that, if you're just a material object, you cannot have any sort of liberty or agency.
Okay.
On the other hand, if you want to be a determinist because of what you find in biology, I mean, you'd have some theological company with all the people in the Reformed camp. So either way, Christianity isn't at a disadvantage, and in fact, with the view that most people hold, which is that we really do have a degree of freedom and agency, you can only get that if you have a dualist view of persons, a view that says we are not just material objects, we are spiritual beings.
So either way, if it's determinist or indeterminist, do you eventually sacrifice human moral responsibility?
I think if you're a naturalist, you do.
You've got to. Okay.
You've got to. Mm-hmm. And not only that, you shouldn't cry about it because you don't think anything is right or wrong anyway.
Right. Right. Exactly.
So it's really a horrifying kind disastrous.
Oh boy.
It's a cold water bath. I mean, yeah. If you throw somebody into that bath, it's a shocker when they really start to see the implications of a materialist, naturalist view of person.
Well, let me summarize it with a proverb. Challenge the fool in his folly, lest he be wise in his own conceits. And I think that's what you've got to do. Enter into the epistemological house of the unbeliever and start kicking things around and see if there's a logical coherency or consistency in the way of thinking, and you certainly don't get that in the naturalistic, materialistic worldview. We really have to equip our people to give an answer for the hope that is within them, and resources like this are really critical to that. Do you think that Christians and the churches across America need this kind of stuff? I mean, give us a little bit of a sales pitch for a second, Brad.
Yeah, I do. And one of the things that I bring up in the book is that, you know, and you mentioned earlier, the 21st century is really becoming the century of the brain. Everywhere you look, this is how people explain every aspect of human life and basically everything it is to be human is and it's very reductionistic in its approach. And so, first of all, Christians need to become a little more discerning and be able to know when a fully robust view of human personhood is being undermined. But then also to be able to talk about that intelligently with unbelievers or with people who've been kind of hoodwinked into this reductionist materialist perspective, and to defend a biblical view of humans, because Christ came to die for us. I mean, this is what it's ultimately all about, is proclaiming the good news, defending the hope we have, and pointing people to Christ for the glory of God.
Amen. The book is God on the Brain, What Cognitive Science Does and Does Not Tell Us About Faith, Human Nature, and the Divine. Our guest today, Dr. Bradley Sickler, and I'd recommend the book. It's Crossway, available anywhere online. Brad, thanks. We appreciate you joining us on Generations Today. I hope this is just one more step to equip the man of God for every good work.
I hope so, too. Thanks for having me.
This is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation.